Today on
Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, the Supreme Court is spending the week hearing legal arguments regarding the legality of Obamacare. 5 days of legal briefings and legal arguments on is Obamacare legal? Wake up! Are you with me? Good. Also, the tragic events in Florida and the case surrounding the shooting of Florida teenager Trayvon Martin. Is the Stand Your Ground law a bad idea? Is this issue being too politicized? Is this thing on? President Obama and the Otkroki Prozhenki Mikrofona. That's Russian for the open mic situation. Speaking of Otkroko Mikrofona, Senator Santorum loses his temper with the New York Times. Is he in the wrong or is he justified? All of this and Tell Me a Story Today on Backroom Politics. Good afternoon, everybody. It's Tuesday, and again, from a slightly broken, yet disparate, yet always entertaining group of people, we are live in Oklahoma, at least I am. We've got the folks up at Shelley's. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio. Joining us from Washington, D.C., as they usually do, is our group of political pundits, starting with the always honorable Alan Moore. Alan, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Joining us from the 202 area code, I'm hoping that's the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, how you doing? Okay.
We know he's trying to get in.
We know he's trying to get in.
Yeah.
Al Swift, I believe, is also on the line. And we're waiting on Al, and hopefully Dr. Ralph Winnie's also on the line.
I'm here. This
hey,
is
Ralph.
Live, right?
How you doing? It is live. Ralph, trust me, this is live. Let's see. Congressman Allen, Bob Hines will be joining us shortly as soon as they can dial in. Part of the fun of live radio. Hey, I'm broadcasting live from the campus of Rogers State University, and there's a lot of activity going around here. But needless to say, the show must go on. Big news happening today is we are in the second day of Supreme Court hearings regarding Obamacare. Is Obamacare legal? And should, in fact, the Supreme Court hear the case? And there's also, after this, 3 more days of arguments about Obamacare. So, Ralph, I want to start with you. Ralph, you were actually in the Supreme Court's hearing yesterday. What did you find? What were some of the highlights you caught?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There was a packed courtroom. There was a lot of excitement. The justices were very well-versed and interested in the case, and they started asking very probing questions. What they were discussing yesterday, the court heard 90 minutes of argument on the Anti-Injunction Act, AIA. The AIA was enacted in 1867 to require any lawsuits challenging tax statutes to happen only after the taxes are paid. So you have to pay first and then sue. And the rationale is that it's important to keep the tax revenues flowing without any nuisance lawsuits getting in the way. And the justices basically wanted to make sure that the tax law did not preclude the court from hearing health care law. If they found that the case was not right, then we would not move into today's arguments on the individual mandate. And one of the questions, Justice Ginsburg noted that the penalty was to induce compliance with the mandate, not to raise revenue generally. Because to be a tax, an act has to be intended to raise revenue. And Justice Ginsburg went on to note that because the penalty was to back up the compulsion to buy insurance, it wasn't a tax. Justice Sotomayor noted a series of exceptions or exemptions from the AIA and wanted to know if there was ever a case where something was found to be a tax for constitutional purposes but not for purposes of the AIA, and no such case was cited. So at the end of the day, justices said that they could move forward, and now we're into the second day where the justices looked at the constitutionality of the individual mandate.
Well, joining us finally on the air, you know, I should just start the show over. Joining us on the air finally, Congressman Al Swift. Al, how are you, sir?
I am just fine.
And Bob Hines dialed in successfully.
I'm fine, too.
Well,
we're two senior citizens who presented ourselves but didn't bring along the phone number.
Oh, well, that always helps. That always helps.
But
hey,
I got a hold of. Go ahead.
Bob, Al, we're talking about the Supreme Court hearings on the Obamacare issue. Ralph Winney was there in the courtroom. One of the things that's interesting is that 5 days of hearings on this, and yet the first hearing happens to be is the Supreme Court going to hear it, and is it even applicable? Bob, you've been probably watching this. What's your take on this? Is it surprising to you that the Supreme Court is actually looking at possibly punting this?
Well, this morning's report is somewhat stronger than the question of will it punt, I think, is probably nil at this point. It sounds to me, based upon the reports that I saw late morning, early afternoon, from reporters who came out of the hearing, was that there were, it looks like, maybe at least five members of the court are seriously looking at the at number one, making a decision, and number two, thinking that the mandate is probably going to fall. Now, they're going to take it out. Now, whether they're going to remove the mandate and let the rest of the law alone, or take the whole thing down, I think is totally up in the air, because they've got another 2-hour debate tomorrow about the severability clause, and that's a serious question. So I suspect that we're going to continue to have a rather interesting debate tomorrow in the court.
Well, Alan Moore, what's your take on all this? What is driving the Supremes from going from one side of the House and just from hearing it and having a soft tone, but today it seems like they're actually taking a very stronger position on Obamacare and the actual Interstate Commerce Clause issue?
Well, remember how this works. The court is made up of some smart guys who were always competing with each other in class back in law school, and they were top of their class. Justice Thomas is the only one who really doesn't engage in the what I'll call the game, the intellectual game, of interrupting whoever is speaking almost no matter what. Today they gave the person representing the Justice Department, representing the administration, 3 whole minutes before interrupting him with questions. So they start engaging almost immediately. They've done the prep. They've seen the briefs, and they want to engage. They want to discuss. And so sometimes they are acting from powerful feelings. Sometimes they're playing devil's advocate. Today, several of them were pushing hard. Well, where would you draw a limit? If you can force people to buy health insurance, what else could you force them to do? And probably the most interesting one was Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice, who was saying people may need emergency services. Can the government compel everybody to own a cell phone? And that ended up consuming a little bit of time. The very fact, though, that people are questioning and asking tough questions about a particular position does not tell us where they're going to end up. I mean, it's a fool's errand to think that because there's some hard questions that then you know just how everybody's going to go. I don't know how it's going to go. And I do think that Ralph's right about yesterday, that they're clearly going to go ahead and look at this other stuff. If they weren't, they wouldn't have scheduled, it seems to me, 3 days to have 3 separate discussions if they were going to decide on the question of yesterday that it's too soon to even consider the stuff. So I think that yesterday was an interesting exercise required because one of the courts said, gee, it's not timely to take this up. It's pretty clear that they're going to take this all up. That's why they're engaged today. That's why they'll be engaged tomorrow. As to the outcome, that's still not known and won't be known for a while.
Al, let me go to you. Congressman Al, what are you finding the takeaways from yesterday that might help drive us to an idea of when the Supreme Court might come down with this? We're talking about a Supreme Court that's even suggested they may wait until after the election. Is that a smart move?
Well, I don't think that would be smart for the court. I think it would be a smart move politically because it keeps the issue, I think, less alive. Well, Bob's making faces. Jump in.
Bob, why are you making faces, Bob?
I'm not making faces. I'm just sitting here listening. But I think that the court concludes its work and goes on summer vacation on the 30th of June. My guess is that probably in the last half of June, this decision will come down because they rarely. I cannot remember of a time when they went out without. Publicly announcing the decisions and on all the matters they've heard that session.
Okay, we resolved that. Bob wasn't making a face; he just stuck with the one he's got. But in terms of what happened yesterday, Nina Totenberg, who of course is the NPR person for the court, and you can make your own judgments about the quality of her reporting, but. She said essentially the decision that they were going to take this up and make a decision was for sure, was certain now. She did not go into any predictions of what that decision would be.
But, Ralph,
what was interesting yesterday is that while addressing the U.S. Solicitor General, Justice Alito noted words to the effect that today, meaning Monday, you are arguing that the penalty is not a tax, so that the AIA shouldn't come into play. But tomorrow, Tuesday, when you argue against the individual mandate, you're going to say the penalty is a tax. So Alito, along with other justices, had a problem with that set of arguments. And it's going to be very, very interesting to see how the dynamics play out because if you talk to people like Peter Barnes with Fox News, someone like Kennedy, Justice Kennedy, has come out and said that the burden on the government is going to be extremely high to prove their case.
This is also the same Justice Kennedy, that said that maybe this market may be unique. Alan, is there any crossover in this coming from Justice Kennedy?
Well. This is the question. Is there something so unique and the public interest so compelling that an exception, if you will, needs to be made? And that's going to be the strength of their case, that it really is unique. And that's what Roberts was trying to challenge when he talked about cell phones and emergency services, strange as that seems as an analogy. So, that's where it's gonna come down, and that's where you have room if you're flexible, if you tend to be more flexible in your interpretation of the Constitution and are willing to adapt it to the circumstances, versus being more a strict constructionist, where you say they didn't contemplate that, and it really does run against the language and intent of a couple hundred years ago.
Hey,
we'll see. That's why we're hearing this.
Bob Hines, go ahead.
One of the things we have to keep in mind, and it struck me from some of the reporters talking today after coming out from listening to the argument, that apparently the Chief Justice was somewhat mild in his questioning today, whereas Justice Kennedy, who is thought to be the most likely swing vote among the Republican members of the court, where Justice Kennedy was very rigorous in his questioning. And the reporters tended to take that as a sign that Kennedy was really possibly going to, you know, throw the whole case out. And I think we have to remind ourselves that a hard question, you know, is not necessarily an indication of I'm trying to gut the bill. It's I want to understand precisely what the arguments are and how strong the arguments sit. And I think you can take it both ways. And I suspect that Kennedy was trying to understand as much as he could precisely what the situation is and how far the Commerce Clause can be reasonably be stretched. So I wouldn't necessarily think just because of Kennedy's searching questions that means he's prepared to throw the case out. I mean, throw the law out.
But Congressman Al, Justice Kennedy has always been kind of that on the fence type justice. Nobody really knows how he's going to vote or how he's going to come out. In one vote, he could be very liberal in his thinking. In another side, he could be very conservative. But this in particular seems to be changing day by day for Justice Kennedy. Is he going to be the linchpin in this, do you think, Al?
I wouldn't be at all surprised if he would. I don't know that the fact that he may appear to be on one side one day and appear to be on the other side the next day is any indication of that. Bob Matsui, the late Bob Matsui, congressman from Sacramento, was a personal friend of Kennedy's. And he, when he was appointed, he said he is truly conservative, but he has a lot of common sense. And I think that's the reason that you find him sometimes doing things that appear to be not conservative, but in fact they may come from a conservative view that has been run through a brain, you know. So I think it's sitting there trying to look into his mind as he asks his questions, I think, is a fool's errand. It's just not gonna happen. What you may foresee is not going to happen.
Well, when we look at the different Kennedys, different justices, Alan Moore, we've seen Justice Thomas almost taking a kind of a laid back look. Is he one of the factors that could be pushing this to get thrown out, and he's already got his decision made? He's been pretty staunch on being Federalist.
Well, first of all, Thomas almost never participates in the verbal argument. He has also said, both in speeches I've heard and to me personally, because he's an old friend of mine, that oral argument typically changes almost nobody's opinion. That usually people know going in what they think and how they're going to come out. They may have a few questions that they want to get answers to, and then they're fighting over each other to ask those questions. Now, having said that, has he made up his mind? I don't know. What most people assume that he will vote to say that the law is unconstitutional. I don't know that. I don't, I think we make a big mistake assuming that we know how things will go. We talked about this issue a couple of months ago, and some of us predicted that it would not be, like I was one of them, it won't be a 5-4. Who knows? You know, that's sort of a guess, you know, flip a coin. Whatever. But conventional wisdom sometimes is right, but it's often wrong on the Supreme Court.
Well, Alan, I think we don't know how this case is going to come down. The justices are seriously evaluating the merits of the arguments, and for people to say it's slam dunk either way, they're very mistaken.
Well, Congressman Al, let's ask this question. Is it politically beneficial to the president for this vote to go 5-4 either way?
Well, it obviously is beneficial to the president if it goes 5-4 his way. If it doesn't, I'm not sure that that's particularly beneficial. You can go around and say, well, it was off the close, but who's going to give you any kudos over that? I don't think he's got to win it or he's going to lose it in the minds of the public, and I don't think you can argue any other way. I would make another observation, however. Sometimes one wonders if people shouldn't be happy with what they get rather than what they're trying to get. Had the Democrats accepted Richard Nixon's health care plan, they would have got something very similar to what they've just proposed, including the mandate, which was totally supported by the Republicans. But, no, it wasn't good enough. So now, and I remember the Republicans back in the 60s vigorously opposing Medicare as socialized medicine and all of this kind of stuff. And yet today you have the Tea Party lady saying, don't you let the government mess with my Medicare. So both sides have shown that time has made them look a little foolish.
You know, when we look at this, Bob, and we see how this is all going to play out on the world stage, or at least in the stage of media, is there any way that Obama could spin this? Should this be taken down, even in something as close as a 5-4 vote?
Are you asking me, Justin?
Yeah, I couldn't hear you quite there. Yes.
Well, if the bill goes, see, tomorrow, I think is given the kind of debate that we heard today, which was rather inquisitive with respect to the validity of the mandate. The question tomorrow is the severability. That's going to be the legal question tomorrow before the justices, whether. Part of the bill can be declared to be unconstitutional, but the remainder of the bill remain in place. And that question, I think, is going to make a decision on how it plays out politically. Because if most of the bill remains, but the mandate is removed, there are other ways to fund it. I mean, there are other ways to fund the bill rather than having a mandate. So the president will still have fundamentally the bill that is the Obamacare bill, but he's got a problem of financing, and he'll have to find a solution to that. And there are several, I think. But so if the entire bill is determined to be unconstitutional for one reason or another, well, that's obvious, at least obviously a political loss for the administration. If the bill can be, if the severability is decided by the justices by a majority, and they say the rest of the bill can stand, then the president can say, well, look, I've improved the medical situation. I'm going to find another way to finance it, and so he can win that.
But Alan, you know, we listen to the argument that Al and Bob are making. You know, when we look back into 1972, and we look at what Romney invoked into Massachusetts, there's a lot of similarity. Obama's now taking the position of, hey, you know, the court can't throw it out. Romney enacted it in Massachusetts. He did it first. Why stop now? Is there accuracy to that?
Well, no, and I don't think that's their argument. It is clear that that it was Republicans who first were suggesting the benefits of a universal mandate. That's been probably I don't recall that that was part of Nixon's, but I'll take Al's word for that. But I do know that this universal mandate idea has been kicking around for 20 plus years, and it originated with Republicans who have had, for various reasons, second thoughts since then. The difference, though, between what occurred in Massachusetts and what occurred in what we'll call Obamacare is a state mandate versus a federal mandate, and the constitutional question has to do with whether the federal government under the Constitution has the power to require everybody to do this, because nobody is arguing the constitutionality of, of the state acting under constitutional authority, what it can require within the state. And Romney has tried to walk that tightrope fairly closely. He can say, this is what we did in Massachusetts. This is why we did it in Massachusetts. I would never propose that or impose that nationwide. I think that's an issue for states to decide.
Yeah, but when
Justin,
go ahead, Bob.
Justin, this is Bob. Stepping in to go a little bit farther on the argument that Alan is making. Remind yourself that the 10th Amendment is very clear that the federal authority, the federal powers of the Congress are set forward, you know, in the Constitution in Article 1, I think, Section 8 or 9. So, you know, those are enumerated powers, and all the other powers, according to the 10th Amendment, remain with the states. So the state has the authority and the ability to do whatever they want to do within the framework of that dictum of that part of the Constitution. They can do a program like what Mr. Romney did, and it's perfectly within the purview of the state, and they can require their own citizens to pony up and join the group. But the fact of the matter is that's not the same thing as the federal constitution, which is different because the limitations on the Commerce Clause are real. They may not be as real as some people would like, but they are real.
But, Alan, when we look at the oral arguments that are coming before the Supreme Court, Obama is absolutely using the Romney mandate as part of their argument for why it can go nationally. The first question is, again, is that argument going to stick with the Supremes? Or the other flip side of this, is this something that could possibly break down Romney and his campaign?
Again, it is not at the heart of their argument. It's the heart of their political argument out in the land. They say, we just took Governor Romney's good idea and built off of it nationally. But the legal case, the constitutional case, is not about challenging what Massachusetts did. It's defending or using what Massachusetts did as the defense before the court. It's, does the federal government have the power under the Constitution to order this kind of mandate across the land? Federal mandate versus state mandate. That's the difference. Politically speaking, that issue is going to play out, and it continues to play out. And we heard more about it this week, and Rick Santorum stepped into it on this very question, trying to argue that Mitt Romney is not in a position to take on the president on what Santorum has said is one of the biggest issues in the campaign. Most people think it's not the biggest issue in the campaign. They think it's the economy. But anyhow, that's there's a political dimension here, but that political dimension is not that relevant in the Supreme Court argument.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to touch a little bit more on what's going on in the Supreme Court. We're going to look down to days 3 through 5 on how this is all going to work out. But until then, this is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics, live from Oklahoma, Washington. I think we've even got one from Maryland and Virginia. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love. To the sun in the day.
Necessarily from Shelley's back room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Some of us are. I believe Al and Bob are in their usual spots. Alan Moore is broadcasting from an undisclosed location somewhere in the national capital region. And then we've also got Dr. Ralph Winnie online. And Carl Toobin, I believe that you're also joining us as well, aren't you, Carl?
I'm here.
Welcome back, sir. Hey, if you're listening to us on Blog Talk Radio, we have been talking for the past few minutes about the Supreme Court's hearing of the Obamacare issue. You know, the funny thing about it is 5 days of Obamacare in the Supreme Court. I want to go to you, Bob Hines. Is this, in fact, a precedence? Have you seen the Supreme Court take up 5 days of policy regarding the regarding something like this that's come out of Congress?
I thought it was 3 days, Monday through Wednesday.
It's three.
Week. Am I wrong?
Oh, it is
it's
3 days.
Three.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've been
it's
saying
three.
Five.
Six
it's
hours,
three days.
3 days.
I think it's 6 hours and 3 days.
My apologies.
I don't know. It certainly is not a an all-time record. I don't know how far back you'd have to go, but it's certainly in modern times. I think I saw something in recently in the newspaper saying that this was the most time any case had been assigned how many hours in somewhat over 40 years, going back probably to I guess wartime practically, so for Second World War. So it's clearly a very significant case. I think it's probably been at least 40 or 50 years since they've had 6 hours of debate on a case. But I doubt that it's an all-time record.
And Congressman Al, I apologize. I wanted to give you the opportunity to extend and revise your remarks from the previous segment.
Yeah, it is a
Al,
good
go
point
ahead.
To do it when we go from 5 to 3 days. We try in this program to be as opinionated as we want to be, but to be sure we're careful of our facts. And I think Alan pointed out that he wasn't sure that the Nixon proposed medical program had a mandate in it. And I am not either. And I want to make it clear, I kind of mixed two things together. He had a program which has many precedents for the current program. And the mandate was started by Republicans in another context. So I just wanted to correct the record.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. But one of the things that we do want to point out, though, is as we are going forward, we keep talking about Obamacare and how that's being perceived by the Supremes. It seems that Justice Scalia is comparing Obamacare to broccoli, isn't he, Alan?
Well, no, you know, he basically said, well, if the federal government can require people to buy health insurance, what else can it require them to do? How about broccoli? That's good for you. So is that something? And people throw out, you know, different kinds of examples. Apparently they spent quite a bit of time today on the subject of could the federal government require everybody to buy a car? Because some people don't buy cars, and that means cars are more expensive for everybody else. And maybe if everybody had to buy a car, they would be cheaper for everyone. And that was something that Paul Clement, a very distinguished counsel appearing at oral argument, was making. All these things are a bit of a stretch, whether it's Roberts on cell phones, Clement on cars, Scalia on broccoli. But they do this to try to draw out the conversation and score some debating points.
And going back to when we were debating Medicare in the late 60s, some of the things that were supposed to have transpired if we passed a communist bill are now just utterly laughable. So.
Oh, no, Al, they weren't laughing at you. There's people here surrounding. The world continues to go on, even though they usually would be listening to our radio show.
Well, I didn't hear them laughing, so they better do it again.
Okay. Hey, just out of curiosity, though, and I want to go to Ralph Whitney on this. Ralph, is there any possibility that the Supreme Court actually might separate this out and divide the rulings into 3, 5, or 6 parts as far as this part of Obamacare may be legal, this part may not?
That's certainly a possibility. I mean, the Obama lawyers, one of their arguments is that by not participating in the marketplace, the uninsured drive up costs for everyone else because everyone's insurance premiums go up. There's an increased usage of emergency rooms. So it's certainly possible that they could separate out and say certain aspects of the Obamacare bill are constitutional while others are not. This is a very historic case, and I don't think anyone knows how it's going to come out. But I think when you're talking, when Alan was bringing up the issue of Romney and his health care program, what Romney has never done is he's not tried to say that he tried to have health care work in Massachusetts, but that it didn't work and explain the reasons why it didn't work. And if he did, perhaps he would turn the issue around rather than trying to say that his health care bill does not go as far as what the Obamacare bill does in terms of affecting the Commerce Clause argument.
Bob, do you think that this could be split up and be a split decision out of the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it's instructive that the court tomorrow has a two-hour session on the question of severability, which in effect means can you take part of the law, take part of Obamacare bill, and call it say that provision is unconstitutional, but the remainder of the act stands, and that's apparently what the debate will be about tomorrow. So the question is, it looks to me like the court at least wants to examine the question of whether part of the bill can be severed away and thrown out as unconstitutional, and the rest of the law stands.
Alan, I want to let you have the last word on this for this segment. Is what's the big takeaway what should be the big takeaway out of these 3 days of hearings with the Supreme Court?
Well, from yesterday, they're going ahead looking at it now. From today, there is obviously a lot of skepticism about the constitutionality of the mandate, but we don't know yet how they'll decide. Tomorrow, as they say, we haven't even heard yet, and that'll be this question of if you find the mandate unconstitutional, what's that say about the rest of the law? I can tell you what it says about the rest of the law, regardless of what the court says. It won't work. It may not be illegal or unconstitutional, but you can't make the law work the way it is set up, which in the easiest example is the requirement that all anybody who wants to get insurance, who doesn't have it now, wants to buy it, can buy it regardless of any pre-existing condition. Now, this has always been a massive hurdle for people, and it's a big problem for somebody who doesn't have it, gets sick, has a need, and comes in and says, give me some health insurance, and they say, sorry, you've got this cancer, you've been in a massive accident, you've got all these expenses that we can see, we can foresee, and we're going to have to charge you for, and people say, I can't spend $20,000 a year for health insurance. And so the idea is you bring everybody in, you bring all the young people in, all the people who've just chosen to either take the risk or you spend their money for something else or don't have the money, and there's a lot of subsidies in here, and say, okay, we're going to try to get people out of the emergency room because that's the national health insurance plan in America. If you don't have insurance, go to the hospital. They have to take you in. They have to treat you, and then you can worry about if you ever get paid. The whole idea behind bringing everybody under the umbrella is a universal mandate. Everybody has to come in, and everybody has to be allowed to buy. If you take the mandate away, all of that collapses, and it won't work. So it doesn't have to be tossed from a constitutional standpoint. It will be non-functioning in many ways, and the Congress will have to go back in a big, difficult, messy way to try to figure out how to salvage what's left when one of the foundational points is ruled unconstitutional, if that's how they decide.
All right, well, we'll let that be the last word for this segment. This is obviously something that we're going to pick up next week, but I think we're all in agreement that we're not going to see rulings out of the Supreme Court, except maybe that they will, in fact, take the case. Is that accurate, Bob?
Yeah, I think yesterday probably indicates that the court probably unanimously believes that they have the authority and the responsibility to go forward and make a decision in the case.
Well, we'll let that be the last word. When we come back, we want to talk a little bit about the case down in Florida, the tragedy regarding Trayvon Martin. We'll focus on that and the politics around that, unfortunately. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., by way of Oklahoma, Virginia, and Maryland. Stay with us. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Thank you. live on Blog Talk Radio. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., by way of Oklahoma, Virginia, Maryland, and Bob and Al are holding down the fort with our team over there at Shelley's. Hey, by the way, a shout-out to Bob, our friend, our host, and purveyor of fine food and cigars over there at F Street. Bob had a great article in the Washington Post magazine with a really, really nice photo. Al, you saw the article in the magazine. What'd you think?
Yes, I did. Well, the photo of Bob was so nice, I didn't recognize him at first. but it was a very nice article, and it talked about...
Get the name of that photographer.
He talked about his background in hospitality, running hotels and so forth and what have you, how confident he was, and how he runs it, that he wants it to be a place where you can have discussions and that there aren't just fights and what have you. And I thought it was very, very nice.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. Hey, I want to transition to a serious note about what's going on down in Florida. The situation regarding the shooting of young Florida teenager Trayvon Martin down in Sanford, which is in Seminole County, a suburb of Orlando. According to reports, it appears that young Trayvon Martin was going through a neighborhood where a arguably overeager neighborhood watch commander who happened to have a carry permit on a weapon in his possession. A confrontation of some sort happened. The details of that are going back and forth. However, young Trayvon Martin lost his life after he was shot by the watch captain down there in Sanford. Immediately causing a stir. Is it racial? Is this self-defense? The reports of the hoodie, the reports of how he was acting are all over the place, but it's tragic when a young man loses his life violently like that, but it does bring up two questions. One, and I want to start with you, Alan. Everybody's calling into question, and there are several states that have these stand your ground laws in place as a means of justifiable self-defense, even if it does involve deadly force. Are the politics around the stand your ground law being overhyped, or is this something that that the country and the states need to take a serious look at?
Well, I think you'll probably find some big regional differences here. Frankly, most of us, like me, had never heard of stand your ground. Most of us don't have concealed carry licenses and don't pack a weapon when we're walking around. You put concealed carry and stand your ground together, and it's a very risky mix in wherever you are. And depending on where you are, you will have people who say, yeah, it's unhealthy, but it's better to have that than to have no such rights for the innocent person who might be out there and might be a victim. And in other parts of the country, they're simply appalled that this kind of combination could exist. So there is no majority view on this thing. I'm guessing that down in Florida, they're saying, is this the best mix? Is this really what we want? Having said that, that's kind of in the background over the high level of emotions and the borderline, pardon the expression, lynching mentality towards this guy Zimmerman. And we don't know the facts yet. And there's a lot of questions about the facts. I was intrigued that one poll showed that 73% of Americans asked said Zimmerman should be arrested, and maybe he should be. But they're, you know, belatedly doing an investigation, and there are a lot of questions about exactly what happened that night. And it's a tragic situation, there is no getting around that. There was a life lost by a young guy who was, for all intents and purposes, or minding his own business, and he ended up dead, which doesn't make Zimmerman a cold-blooded killer. It just means a really, really tragic thing occurred, and hopefully cooler heads will prevail, because there are some people trying to take advantage of this situation on both sides of all sides, and we need calmness here, figure out the facts, take appropriate actions in this particular case, and also reflect on whether the underlying laws that helped contribute to this make sense.
Right.
I completely agree with Alan that I got a little uneasy with the rush to judgment as to what Zimmerman was doing, what the young man was doing. You know, we don't know that yet, and we shouldn't be making judgments about either one of them, there's guilt or innocence. But this seems clear to me. Now, Zimmerman had an injury in the back of his head, and he had something on the front of his face. So there was something going on. But I would be willing to bet that if we could know all of the facts, that the one thing you could say when you were done is, had it not been for the Stand Your Ground law, the young man would not be dead.
Bob, let me ask you.
Can I say something?
Absolutely, Carl. Go ahead.
Carl, the interesting thing is that unfortunately, because the police didn't move, and because other authorities didn't move, there's a lot of evidence and a lot of things that should have been collected that night that haven't been done, and unfortunately, justice might not be able to be done in this situation because it's so muddled, and I think that's a real disgrace to the system.
Carl,
I actually
got to disagree with you on that one, Carl. I will tell you that, you know, especially in a high profile case like this, I think that the actions of the police are over scrutinized. I mean, being formally in law enforcement, you know, there's that fine line. They still have to conduct an investigation. There's still a presumption of innocence on Zimmerman, which is actually going to lead me to a question I want to go to Al with. But I think for there to say that there's a muzzle on the case and the investigation itself, I don't think it's fair to not only the police officers that have to investigate it. There's a lot of pressure on them to get this exactly right. But there's also, you know, the quick run to judgment. And Congressman Al, I go to you. When we look at the media, is the media part of the problem of why there is this quick rush to judgment on Zimmerman, or this quick judgment on Trayvon Martin as being some thug because he had a hoodie on?
First of all, let me say to our good friend in Maryland, don't feel like the Lone Ranger. You should have been here the day that virtually everybody in Shelley's took on the moderator on his views on police, and so people leave that for another occasion. He defends the police to the very bitter end. The answer to the question about the media is, of course, the media always rushes in and hypes and tries to breaking news every time they find a fingernail, and there's just nothing we can do with it. We got to live with it. It's worse in Great Britain, I guess, but it's disappointing.
But look, I got something too.
Yeah, go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, just back to the Carl point. It does seem to me that the day this happened and the immediate days following. Remember, it was February 26th that this event happened, over 4 weeks ago. So I think that the local police did miss some opportunities in the immediate aftermath. It took a while for this issue to then percolate. The sheriff had to step aside
The police chief.
For the time being. Or, pardon me?
The police chief from Sanford.
I mean,
correct.
The police chief had to step aside because their handling in the early days was so controversial. Now you've got Justice Department in there. You've got a couple of investigations going on, but it is entirely possible that evidence that might have existed immediately thereafter no longer exists. There was the only person present that's still alive is Zimmerman, and there were a couple of the so-called eyewitnesses who came onto the scene just as everything was occurring. That's all going to have to be sorted out. But I think that whether it was a travesty or not, I don't know. I mean, people are human, and the guys who got the initial report from Zimmerman realized apparently that he was beat up in some ways, broken nose and bloody head, and took his word for it. And it took them a while to come back and really start gathering the information, and that's unfortunate. Having said that, once it started to take off, the media started to run with it. Al Sharpton got down there. Jesse Jackson got down there. You know, and sometimes those guys can play very constructive roles in a volatile situation, and other times they can stir things up a bit. You've got some outside forces now. There's a group called the New Black Panther Party that's put up a $10,000 bounty, so-called, for the arrest of Zimmerman. Louis Farrakhan has said that there's going to be retribution, and it will be significant and soon. You know, there's just some very, very provocative, troubling statements coming out of people. Meanwhile, this family has lost a son, and that's the core tragedy. And hopefully, we can learn some lessons from it and not do further damage before we get to those lessons.
You know, the other problem that we see is, you know, on the other side, we see somebody like Geraldo Rivera, who made comments right after this incident went national, where he is quoted as saying, "I am urging the parents of black and Latino youngsters particularly not to let their children go out wearing hoodies. I think the hoodie is as much responsible for Trayvon Martin's death as George Zimmerman was." I mean, that just, to me, is part of the problem of the ignorance that's being spewed out there in the media today and in the media on the 24-hour news cycles. Al, am I wrong in that assessment?
No, you're absolutely right about it. I think of all of the reactions that have been made, the best one was the one that the president made, in which he showed sympathy with the parents of the young man, made no suggestion as to what caused it or who was responsible, and that's about as far as one can go based on the limited facts. And it was kind of elegant the way he handled it, as compared with how the inelegant 24-hour news people handle anything.
But Bob Hines,
there was some really interesting commentary from a number of African American journalists, including Donna Britt, who used to write for the Post, who said this brings, and I think she's written a book where she touches on some of this, the men in her lives, a husband and two sons, grown sons. She said that African-American families, and all African-American parents know this, get to a point where their little boys, you know, from 10, 11, 12, as they start to go into junior high and high school, have to sit down for what they call the talk. And the talk refers to parental guidance about the world beyond the neighborhood, the world out there where black boys may be targeted for behaviors that are the norm where they live, and that they need to understand that that there is profiling done, there is prejudice out there, there are things that are unfair and frightening, and that parents try to inform their kids about it. I'm not saying that has any particular relevance to this particular case. I'm just saying that it was a real interesting educational reminder for those of us who are white, who don't worry the same way. We raise our kids and we warn our sons about some things. We warn our daughters about other things. But we don't have what would be referred to as the talk in the African American community. And I just found that really interesting and instructive.
Yeah, but Alan, I want to jump in on this real quick, because Alan, it strikes me as if that we're almost creating the nature at a young age when we have these quote unquote talks with these young individuals, whether it's a young girl or a young boy saying, hey, look, this is reality. We're actually contributing more to the problem. They become jaded. They become more defensive. They become more, it's almost creating another phase of prejudice or judgmentalism.
Well,
I don't
like
agree at
down
all.
And talking
I think
to the kids about sex and saying that's going to make them go to bed with somebody immediately. I just don't think that's true.
Alan, go
ahead.
Well,
you have Al Sharpton talking about a national summit on race. So this issue that Alan raised would be very interesting to see if that would get discussed if a national summit does get established. But what was also interesting for me is I was watching Meet the Press, and they had Ben Jealous, president of the NAACP, on, and he raised a very interesting point. He said black men, young black men, are seen as more suspicious by other black men, namely black cops. And that's been an interesting phenomenon that is starting to affect the black community.
Alan Moore, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say most crime committed by African-American males is committed on other African-Americans.
Yep.
And so there's not a pure white versus black prejudice. There is, or set of suspicions or fears. There's a great deal of concern and suspicion even among blacks, because the crime most likely to be committed is black-on-black crime in America. And I think parents are well aware of this, and they try to educate their children the best they can because they want to protect them. I do not in any way see that as contributing to the problem. It's just a sad statement and really useful reminder for all the rest of us about some of the extra burdens that African-Americans have in surviving in this society.
Congressman,
Justin,
go ahead.
It occurs to me that this would be a very, very good topic for a program we could put on the shelf for sometime when we can't air. There is sitting out in the other room here at Shelley's today a good friend of yours, a black man who would speak very, very intelligently to this issue. And the fact that there are four or five white guys sitting around discussing it seems to me to be kind of indicative of something, too. I would love to get this topic and get some adult black men to weigh in as well.
You know what? That's not a bad idea, Al. And that's one of the great, great things about having the Freeform show that we have. Because ironically, Al, we're going up against the break right now. Obviously, this is not the last we're going to hear about this story. This is a story that's going to keep national attention. It's something that the media has glommed onto, right or wrong. It has gotten very good press in some instances and very bad press in others. But it's just continuing to add to some of the divides that are still prevalent in our country today. When we come back, we're going to go to a much lighter note. We're going to talk about President Obama and Otkryot Ploshny Mikrofona. That's Russian for the open mic situation. We'll be back here in about 3 minutes. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., by way of Oklahoma, Maryland, and the Commonwealth of Virginia. Stay with us.
East of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love, dear, near to the sun in the day and near to the moon.
From Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., by way of Oklahoma, Virginia, Maryland. And, Al, you're still in Washington, right?
Yeah, Al's in Washington.
Al's in, oh, that's right. He's off ordering martinis, which reminds me, it is that time of the day. It's 5 o'clock somewhere. It's happy hour. This is the part in Backroom Politics where we order our favorite cigar, our favorite drink, and can take this show home finally once and for all, because I got to tell you something, multitasking is hard. I need a drink, and yet I can't do that here on the beautiful campus of Rogers State University. Hey, when we went to break, we were talking about the tragic situation in Florida. We're going to lighten it up right now and talk about, and again, I'm going to try this again. Here we go. Otkroki porzhenny mikrofona, which is the open mic situation. For those who are not familiar with the microfona situation, President Obama and Soviet President Medvedev were involved in a discussion that everybody thought was off mic. Turns out, live microphone in play. And I can paraphrase. There are some that say that President Obama pretty much told Medvedev, I've got this thing in hand. I'll deal with this after the election. Some were saying, including the White House, saying it's a hard time to talk about some of these issues because of the fact we're both in election cycles. Either way, it got world attention, including on the fact that Medvedev kind of took a step back and is now commenting on the comments made by President Obama. First, let's go to you, Ralph. Ralph, how did Medvedev take that comment and the fact that, well, he's pretty much a lame duck president in Russia right now anyway?
Well, you know, Medvedev and other Russians, they do not like to be insulted publicly. And if it's perceived as a direct insult, it does not go very well, either with Medvedev or with the Russian people. That being said, they have always viewed Obama as an opportunist, as someone that maybe they could control or manipulate. And if they think he's not going to do or engage in certain policies until after the election, it does play in their favor, at least the next president that comes in to Russia. So it was a very, very bad move, I think, on Obama's part. You don't want to give all of your cards away to the Russians, because they're very crafty, right. They're very smart, and you've got to stand your ground.
Well, you know, but this is, wait a minute. Ronald Reagan did a countdown to bombing Moscow. George Bush pointed out to the vice president at a meeting that Adam Clymer, I think was his name, there's that son of a bitch from the New York Times that
Easy,
wrote a bad
Al,
article
Al,
about
Al,
us.
We're a family show, sir.
He used a different word that starts with an A.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I don't think you want me to use the word that he used.
Yeah, okay.
but it was a swear word.
Justin,
and,
let me in here when you can.
These things happen, and they, you know, they normally don't turn into anything.
Right. You know, fellas,
what we're talking about here is
the President of the United States speaking the truth, and it's embarrassing when you say things like that and they get out in public, but we all know that, he'd have more flexibility after he, potentially, you know, it depends on more what their House is and the Senate, but the fact of the matter is a president who's newly elected and doesn't have to worry about re-election has a lot more freedom of action than he does before his election. And I think, you know, the president was, it's an unforced error, but it isn't a serious error. And fundamentally, we all know that he was speaking the exact truth.
Well, when we look at
Justin?
Yeah, go ahead, Alan.
Yeah. This is a bigger deal, I think, than these guys are saying. First of all, I think it has absolutely nothing to do, with all respect, Al, with the examples you made, which were Ronald Reagan joking, making a clear joke with in front of the camera, not realizing it was going to be recorded and shared, and with regard to the Cheney Bush comment about Adam Clymer, just two guys calling somebody a jerk, but in other words, this is the President of the United States talking to the head of Russia for the moment until Putin comes back in, saying, hey, pass the word to your colleague, your successor, that you know, don't get too excited here, I'll have more flexibility after the election. That's a world of difference. And it is, if you will, Obama's etch-a-sketch moment, where he'll say, in effect, we're going to have a redo after I'm reelected. But it's coming out of his mouth. In the etch-a-sketch problem for Romney, it was a staff guy saying, "Well, you know, once we have the nomination, we'll shake up and redirect ourselves in the main campaign." This I think neutralizes. In a lot of important ways, the argument against Obama and whether, you know, this whole etch-a-sketch business, and more fundamentally means that Obama is going to be asked going forward oh, we know what you said you're going to do, but are you going to be more flexible than you say when if you're reelected on Afghanistan, on Iraq, on the Middle East, on health care, on jobs, on taxes? I think this is something that's going to have echo effects that we're going to be hearing about throughout the rest of the year.
Bob Hines, let
me ask you
a question.
Well, I think after listening to that eloquent defense of those, my reaction is good try.
Wow. Wow. Well, but let me ask this question, though. When we, you know, Bob Hines, when we look at, you know, the interaction between the president and Medvedev, when we look at now the Russian president's talk to the GOP, where he says, and I quote, "I always get very cautious when I see a country resort to phrasing such as number one enemy. It is very reminiscent of Hollywood in a certain period in history." He's obviously taken a little bit of exception to, one, the comment that Obama made, and two, it's gone public. Bob?
I think it's a tempest in a teapot. Personally,
really?
I don't think it's that serious. I know that undoubtedly there'll be some opportunities for during the campaign to say this is, you know, you shouldn't be saying things like that to the Russians if you feel that, you know, because of their they'll take advantage of you. But I really don't think it's that big a deal.
But Carl, you had a comment.
My comment is that you know, I think President Obama has had a very good relationship with this Russian president and felt that, you know, he could send a message through him to the incoming president, the former president of the Soviet Union, or former president of Russia, Putin. And I think that, you know, I agree with Bob. It's not that big a deal. It might come up in the campaign. Alan is right. There could be a lot of questions and thrown by reporters, Republicans, are you going to change this? Are you going to change that? Are you going to reverse yourself on this? You know, but I think that he was stating his opinion and wanted to get that to President Putin so that he would know and Putin will react to way he will react, whether he'll do it publicly or privately, we'll have to wait and see.
Alan, I'm going to go to you on this, but I think Medvedev, his comments are also directed at, in particular, Mitt Romney, but Speaker Boehner is also coming to Medvedev's defense by saying, hey, look, this is just not how we're operating today. You can't keep putting Russia on the same stage as it was 40 years ago. It's a different world. Is he right in that?
Well, the world is changing. Russia is a shadow of its former self, propped up only by rising oil prices. It is really a mess, declining longevity, horrible fertility rate, terrible public services. It really is a mess, but it's also got a huge number of nukes and a lot of potential. It's a massive, though a terribly underpopulated country. I think the only thing here that matters is not that a president's going to be flexible later. That's how we're shocked that a president might take a public position and then have to be a little more flexible behind the scenes. It's just that it was out of his mouth and it came at absolutely the wrong time when they're trying to lay this flip-flopping, infinitely, pardon the expression, flexible Mitt Romney. And it's Obama himself who said, "I'll be able to be a lot more flexible later." That's the only point that I'm making. Not that anybody's really surprised at this. It's just that it is something that I think we're going to hear about over and over again, because it's a strong refutation to one of the main arguments that they were intending plan to use against Romney.
Congressman Al, has this situation with Medvedev caused the doomsday clock to get closer to midnight, or are we still kind of out there about quarter till?
I think we're still where we were. this can have some repercussions, I think, domestically, politically, and it's going to require some behind-the-scenes smoothing over through the State Department and others with the Russians to the extent that they were embarrassed by it. But I think that's it.
Ralph, is this going to have implications? Is this going to help Putin's positioning coming into the presidency down the road?
I think down the road, something like this does serve to embolden Putin. The key is you have to be consistent in your approach and foreign policy relations with the Russians. You cannot be perceived as being someone that goes back and forth, shifts with the winds. The key is to have a consistent working relationship with Russia to solve a lot of these international problems that the world community faces.
By the way, for those of you who were interested in the doomsday clock, according to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, it's 5 till midnight. I guess we're getting closer and closer to a problem with Soviet Russia or the old Russian states. For those of you who were asking, hey, I think we're going to let that be the last word. When we come back, we're going to talk about presidential politics. We're going to talk about Senator Santorum losing his temper with the New York Times and the results of the Illinois and Louisiana presidential runs. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us. Thank you. And we're back live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital by way of Oklahoma, Maryland, Virginia. And Bob and Al still holding down the fort there in Washington, D.C. Real quickly, we want to talk about presidential politics. We want to talk about the results of Illinois and Louisiana happening since we last came to you. Alan, to start with you, what surprised you about Illinois?
How big the Romney victory was, 12 points, and how dreadful Gingrich did, 8 points. Those were the two surprises for me.
Are we starting to see the divide, Bob Hines, between the true Bible Belt voters that are going Santorum and the divide between the bi-coastal voters of California, New York, when it comes to them voting for Romney? Are we in fact getting closer and closer to a contended convention in Tampa?
Well, it looks to me, if you look at, you know, you have to take as a given, many of the southern states are going to be strongly Republican. They don't like the president very well, and they're going to be strong Republican votes already, and that's where Santorum is winning. Romney is out winning the states you have to win if you're going to win the election. You've got to win Ohio. You've got to do well in Wisconsin. He's winning places you have to win. It won't be so easy to win. Virginia was atypical because everybody wasn't in the race, but he did very well there. So, you know, you look at it and you say to yourself, that's the reason that people like Jeb Bush and other senior Republicans around the country are saying, you know, Romney's the guy, let's get behind him, because they can see that he's going to get there. He's going to be our best choice for the candidate. And let's hope that enthusiasm will build for him as he gets closer to the nomination, because obviously there are a lot of Republicans who are not enamored of him at this point. But I think every week or 10 days, as we get a few more primaries behind us, it seems pretty clear to me that there is no chance at all for anyone else to be the candidate but the former governor of Massachusetts.
Congressman Al, when we look at the endorsements that came out last week, i.e., most importantly, Jeb Bush, we're starting to see more and more of the traditional anybody else but Mitt Romney's, namely Senator Jim DeMint, looking more and more lackluster, although getting behind Mitt Romney. And even though Santorum's winning the southern states, he's not winning the delegates. At what point does everybody just call no joy in this, Congressman Al?
At what point did they just call what?
They just call no joy, and they just decide to say, look, he is the nominee. When do we start seeing possible Gingrich pull out, Paul pull out, and the Santorum fight it all the way to Tampa?
I don't think either Gingrich or Paul will pull out. They'll just continue to be irrelevant. They'll be playing for a little bit of influence in the convention. Santorum, I don't know when he's going to pull out or whether he's going to pull out, because he represents the Tea Party and the ultra-right wing of the Republican Party, and I don't know whether he wants to walk away from them. I can't imagine, given the current state of the Republican Party, that whole wing of the party wanting to be useless in the convention. I think they want to be heard. So I think this is going to be a hard one to bring together. You're right. The party elders, if you will, who are looking at this coldly in terms of the general election, wish to hell. I can't say that.
No,
anymore.
Wish to hell you can say, Al. That's fine.
Oh, listen, I can say that. Okay. I've got to check these with you ahead of time so I know which ones to use. They're going to wish with all their might that they could get this done, because they've got a lot of rebuilding to do for Romney, given the tearing down that has taken place in the primary, and they need time to do that. And so any sensible politician in the Republican Party would say, let's close this up and start running against the president. And whether they'll have the good sense to do that in time or not, I don't know. Bob would be in a better position, I suppose, to analyze his party in that regard.
Bob Hines?
I think Al's right. I think that, as I said earlier, the senior people are clearly moving toward Romney. No major player has come out and recently supported Santorum. He's going to be in it probably as long as he can. I think it's interesting that I saw something this morning. Gingrich is now charging people $50 to have his picture taken with them. Boy, that's a way to raise money. That's a hell of a way to raise money.
He's like Johnny Bench's baseball card.
But think about that. I mean, if that's where he is, he's, I guess his big backer has gotten smart. He's not trying
pretty
to draw to an inside straight. He's not trying to draw to an inside straight. And
pretty
you know,
soon he's going to be running the ring toss.
Reality is, I think Gingrich is in it for the ego. That's all he is.
Well, it's
and
ironic.
I think he's hurting the ability of Santorum to obviously win more delegates. But I don't think he cares. And
yeah,
I think
Bob,
if he stays in, he'll keep damaging Santorum in effect. And I think that Santorum will continue to do well in southern states and possibly in Pennsylvania. It's at least certainly in the western half, but I don't see a whole lot of places where he's going to win a lot of votes.
And
in the primary process, I think fundamentally it's going to be over by the end of certainly by the end of May and probably by the end of April.
Bob, we've got a caller on the line. Caller from the 203 area code. You're on the air.
Yes, I've just called in to listen.
Okay, that's fine.
I learn a lot. I've listened before, and I learn a lot.
Well, we appreciate you calling in. Stay with us. We'll put you back on hold. Bob, you know, it's ironic you brought up Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich, today it was announced that Politico, our friends over there at Politico, and the AP were pulling their embedded print journalists. And so basically the three or four networks are basically sticking around for television coverage, because, you know, where there's a Newt Gingrich, you could probably roll tape and get something good. But is this the final life support? Could this finally be the death blow to the Newt Gingrich campaign that everybody's been talking about? Bob?
You know, let me also mention that this morning,
you know,
they also said that
hold on.
Fundamentally irrelevant for about a couple of weeks, and I think maybe now it may be so strongly visible to Mr. Gingrich that he may let his ego down for a minute and realize that he's doing nothing to help himself. He's not making himself any more friends in the senior levels of the party, and it clearly is his own ego, and he really ought to start thinking about something besides himself.
Carl, go ahead.
Yeah, the other thing is that the other thing I heard this morning on the radio is the fact that his wife is still out campaigning for him. Now, you know, he stopped, but she's still going. So this is kind of a split decision here I'm sure that he's going to get out of sometime soon because of the money situation. The other thing is that I've been thinking about this for a few weeks, that if I were a Republican, I would be worried that in these primaries, as hot as they've been, the vote totals have been lower than former years. And you know, you have to ask yourself, is it the candidates? Is it the fight? I mean, you know, is it the base? Is the base not really revved up for an election? And how do you change that?
Justin?
Yeah, go ahead, Alan Moore.
Yeah, a couple things. First of all, on Newt, Newt has been a dead man walking here for a couple of weeks. I think that his 8% in Illinois and his 16% in Louisiana were the final nails in his coffin. He's out of money. He's out of energy, as Bob points out. He's charging people, and I don't think they're lining up for these $50 photos. They're more lining up because it's like visiting Lenin's tomb in Russia. You want to see him before they remove it. He's cutting back his schedule. I'm guessing that, you know, next week we've got D.C., Maryland, and Wisconsin. He'll come up with a dreadful showing there, and I suspect shortly thereafter he'll be gone just because he doesn't have the dough and it's embarrassing. And what he does have some pride. He's got an ego, but he's also got some pride and doesn't want to be a laughingstock. So I think that he's done. I just wanted to say one word about Carl's comment about turnout. The turnout results this year are actually mixed. In a lot of states, they're up from before. The places where they're down tend to be places where there were other measures on the ballot 2 years ago that helped bring people out. So I don't think there's that isn't to say there's an enormous amount of enthusiasm here for any of these guys, and some people are going out just to vote against folks. But some analysis that I've seen is that it's not as bad as you think when you factor in some of the things 2 years ago that gave a boost 4 years ago that gave a boost to turnout because of unrelated issues.
Well, let's look at Rick Santorum though. Rick Santorum's claiming this large victory by winning Louisiana, but he's not gaining per se in the delegate count. It's almost like every time he gets two, Romney's pulling out 1.5.
Santorum is he has to win outside of the South, like places like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, and he has to deny Romney delegates. And if you look at next month, it's not going to be kind to Santorum because you have Connecticut, New York, D.C., and Maryland, which tend to favor Mitt Romney. So the odds of Santorum catching Romney is going to be a very long shot. All he can do is deny Romney the nomination outright and force a contested battle at the RNC convention.
Well, I'll tell you, it's going to be interesting to see how Santorum's going to be able to pull out more delegates than Romney in this race. But the one thing we are seeing, though, is Senator Santorum losing his cool.
He's not going to get the New York Times endorsement, that's for sure.
I would venture to say that's probably an accurate statement. The situation we're talking about is Senator Santorum made a statement basically calling, and I'm going to paraphrase, and I'm probably going to hype it up because I am part of the hyped-up media, basically saying that Mitt Romney was the worst Republican on earth and that we'd be better off having another 4 years of Obama instead of having Romney. Santorum is claimed, as we all have and they all do, that he was taken out of context and confronted the New York Times about it when asked, why would you make a comment about Obama being in 4 years better than having Romney in the White House? And it got, dare I say, a little heated. Al, can you understand Senator Santorum's frustration, or is this just part of his normal temper? He's always had a reputation of being kind of temperamental.
Well, he has been very, very controlled. I must tell you that having served with him in the House, the Rick Santorum we have been seeing on the presidential campaign trail is unrecognizable compared to the Rick Santorum I used to listen to on the floor of the House. The arrogance is gone from his presidential campaign. Maybe that's coming back. The sarcasm, the putting down of people, all of that was very, very typical of his performance in the House, to some degree in the Senate, though I wasn't there. And it has been really absent. He's been a likable guy up to now in his presidential campaign, which has surprised. Now that you said that, I can use the word that surprised the hell out of me.
Very good, Al. You kept it censored. That's good. Bob, has the media been unfair to Rick Santorum, do you think?
I'm sorry, there's a good bit of background noise here. What did you say?
Has the media been unfair to Rick Santorum?
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, I don't think so at all. I think it's been fair. It's given him some very good opportunities, which he's taken advantage of. But I think Al is correct. I mean, I did not know Santorum personally when he was in the House and in the Senate, but I had to deal with him a little bit with respect to my responsibilities with NBC. And he was always sort of a smart aleck. Aleck is a nice way to put it. A smart, you know what I mean. And he was just—he was always sarcastic. He was a little bit full of himself, and he's been very disciplined, I think, during the campaign. But I gather it's coming out a little bit now. I don't think the guy has a chance at all, and I think he—I think he's getting frustrated, and I think he realizes that he's winning states, but he's not winning enough of the votes in the states. He's winning what he did in in Louisiana. He won 40% to 27% to Romney. So he gets a little more than half of the delegates, but not a whole lot. He's not really cutting in to every week. He doesn't win more delegates any week than Romney wins in that week, and he usually goes a lot less. So you know he's just falling behind continually, and I think it's getting to him.
Congressman Al,
Remember that he's not losing any of his base by having a fight with the New York Times.
Well, no.
But on the other hand, if he needs to take, as Ralph has said, if he needs to make some showing in Pennsylvania or whatever, he's not making any friends there.
And I would suspect that he will not win Pennsylvania particularly strongly. I mean, obviously his base is in the West, and he'll do well out there. But he lost his senatorial race because he only won the West in Pennsylvania. And I doubt that Philadelphia will be any more friendly to him now than it was 12 years ago.
And a large part of his loss of the Senate seat was, I believe, this is just my belief, was the way he behaved as a senator.
Yeah, I think so too.
And a very different personality than we have seen on the presidential campaign trail.
Well, Justin.
Alan, go ahead. Alan Moore.
Can I get in here a little bit? Yep. Two things. Let me maybe I go there first, because you've heard me talk about Santorum before. Santorum did a lot of growing up. Between the time he was in the House and he was in the Senate, he was the number three elected member of leadership in the Senate. And that doesn't come easily. That's not automatic. You have to earn that. You have to get along. You have to win the votes. And I was in the Senate from 2001 to 2005, and I watched him work. And I was oftentimes very impressed with the way he worked behind the scenes, not trying to be the show horse or be the out front guy on every issue, but trying to make things happen, reach across to the House to see where people were. And I think he did a lot of growing up and maturing. I think what happened when he – so I think that some of the – we'll call it the bad Rick that we're seeing again – you didn't see nearly as much in the Senate as you did in the House, at least after he was there a while and realized that he better learn how to get along or he wasn't going to go anywhere. Which is not to say that it wasn't buried in there, and we've seen some of that coming out. So I think that the reason he lost by 18 points in his race in the Senate was some national trends, an attractive opponent, and some positions on social issues that resonated with some and really offended others, not the hot-headed stuff that we're beginning to see some now that reminds us of him in times past. I wanted to say one other thing, though, about his exchange with the New York Times, because there were you were mixing up, I think, two different incidents. On the one hand, about 10 days ago or so, he said, hey, Romney is so much like Obama that you might as well just put Obama back in and not take the chance on a new guy. Even Gingrich jumped in response to that, said, I'll take Romney any day over Obama, and Romney, and then Obama, and then Rick said, Santorum said, oh, I got carried away, I was wrong. Yeah, I would too. The incident with the New York Times grew out of a thing just a couple of days ago where he was saying, and he'd been saying regularly, Romney is not the guy to take on Obama on Obamacare because it looks so much like the Massachusetts plan. It's been kind of a theme that he's been making, but
right.
On that particular day, and I've seen the videotape of it, he was saying Romney is the worst Republican that we've got to take on Obama, but he didn't say because of Obamacare. He just said the worst Republican we've got. And on a rope line, the New York Times guy said, so you said he was the worst Republican we've got? And Santorum got all offended. He said, I didn't say that. I said because of the health care issue. And then the reporter said, but that wasn't what you said it inside. He said, that's what I've been saying every time. And he got very short. And he said, and if you write something otherwise, then it's bull stuff. And then he tried to say, hey, any conservative Republican who doesn't get into an argument with the New York Times isn't a real conservative. But it was one more factor to remind us that he is tiring, he's losing his discipline, he's sounding increasingly undisciplined and desperate.
Wow, very very good observation, Alan. Yeah, one of the great things, one of the great privileges I have as moderator is I get to paraphrase quite a bit. You're absolutely right. There were two different instances, but I think that it's a combination. The New York Times has actually been, I think, kind of fair to Santorum, considering. But I guess he just had enough of the New York Times, how do we say it, bull and the word that normally Congressman Al would say after that. When we come back,
do you want me to say it now or
no,
later?
Congressman, we're good. Trust me, we're
okay, good. All right. I'll restrain myself.
Thank you. When we come back, we're going to go to my favorite part of the show. It's Tell Me a Story, where we go around and talk about the buzz, the scoops, and everything else that we can think of going on around the Beltway, inside and outside the Beltway, and around the country politically. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. Hey, relax, everybody. We'll be live all in Shelley's next week, so it gets better from here. Stay with us.
da 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 da.
Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., by way of the beautiful windswept lands of Oklahoma, where the winds come racing down the plain, by the way, and by way of Washington, D.C., where Al and Bob are holding down the fort at Shelley's, and with us also, Carl and Ralph holding down the fort in Maryland and Virginia, respectively. Hey, real quick, this is my favorite part of the show. This is Tell Me a Story. I actually have a story this week, but we're going to start with Professor – actually, we'll go with Congressman Al Swift. Al, tell me a story.
First of all, I'm going to compliment the producer, that's you, on the music. That last piece of music was great, and you got to tell me the name of it. I want it.
That's actually Kid Ory, by the way. That's actually Stompy Jones Jazz – or I'm sorry – Jet Black Blues by Kid Ory.
Really? That was
yes.
Wonderful.
Good stuff.
I had this feeling all along in this area, and I have been wrong so many times in my life going with my instincts. But it seems to me that what the Republicans are going to end up with is a not particularly strong candidate, an awkward candidate, who has spent an enormous amount of time being beaten up by the Republicans, that when he finally goes into the general election, the situation will be that it will be Obama's campaign to lose.
Okay. Interesting. Interesting. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
By this time next week, Wisconsin will be finishing up its voting, and I think that the former governor will do very well up there. So by the 1st of April, which is very short, you know, we're a couple days into April, we will have a situation where almost nobody of significance in the Republican Party will think there is any candidate possibility except Mr. Romney, and everybody will begin to slowly coalesce around him with respect to both money and support, trying to close up this struggle we've got going on right now, close it up as fast as possible so we can start to rehabilitate and strengthen our candidate against the situation we've got to deal with in November. And I think it's going to start as soon as we get past the Wisconsin vote.
Interesting. Ralph Winnie, tell me a story.
Okay, roughly 2 weeks from now, the jobs numbers are going to be published in the media. This is going to determine the narrative of the campaign.
Okay. Carl, tell me a story, Carl Tubin.
I was listening to the radio, and I happened to have to go to a meeting in the Senate Visitor Center and walk past the Supreme Court and all that was going on. But one particular person on the radio this morning got to me, and that was a woman who was praising President Obama for Obamacare, saying that she had breast cancer, and before Obamacare was signed, she couldn't get the she couldn't afford, or if she paid for it, she would go broke, the treatment that she needed for breast cancer. And she was saying that because of Obamacare, she was able to get the treatment she needed. She didn't have to go bankrupt. She didn't have to lose her house, and her children could go to college. And I thought that just hit me like a ton of bricks.
Wow. Alan Moore, tell me a story.
Yeah, that story is interesting because all of those required mandates still aren't in effect. But nonetheless, I'm sure there are some stories that have occurred like that anyway. I want to talk a little. I want to build on what Bob was saying, you know, but make it specific to Santorum, since I already called Newt the dead man walking. He'll be out after Wisconsin. Santorum is the deeply wounded, the gravely wounded man walking, who's sort of on his last legs. Next Tuesday, April 3rd, that's Wisconsin, Maryland, and D.C. Romney will do well. I agree with Bob, Wisconsin's the big one. Then it's 3 weeks until Connecticut, Delaware, New York, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island. The only question in my mind is whether Santorum hangs in till April 24th, when Romney again will have a very good day, or possibly drop out because he doesn't want to be embarrassed in Pennsylvania and on that whole day. But also, he said something really interesting this week. He was asked in an interview, Santorum, whether he would be willing to serve on a ticket with Romney. And he said, of course, I'll do anything that I can for the good of the country and the good of the party. That tells me that he's reassessing his own situation. He's embarrassed himself. People are dredging up all the old ugly things he has said because he's gone negative and nasty and running out of steam. And all the party leaders, Jeb Bush last week, Kevin McCarthy this week, one of the House leaders, have all gotten behind Romney. It becomes really impossible to stay in there. I think he's done too much damage for himself to be considered as a VP candidate. I think we're going to be hearing more about people like Marco Rubio and Portman and John Thune and others. But I think Santorum won't be long, and then the coalescing will occur.
Very good. I have a story this week, and I've only got a minute 50 to tell it real quickly. Our friend who's been on the show numerous times, our friend Dakota Wood, is running for Oklahoma's 2nd Congressional District down in Claremore. He's also got five opponents in a primary. One of his opponents right now, a guy by the name of Mark Wayne Mullen, the Claremore Progress is reporting today that he is staring down the barrel of several FEC violations, and they're starting inquiries on that. So that's a developing story. I had to go home, or you know I had to do that, guy. But I did want to say that it is getting interesting down here in Oklahoma, guys. So if you guys want to have some fun, come on down. We'll have fun down here. No takers?
Good luck in the primary.
Yeah.
No takers? Anyway, on behalf of Congressman Al Swift, Bob Hines, Alan Moore, Dr. Ralph Winnie, Carl Kuvin, I am your moderator, JT Russell, and we will be back next week, all of us live in the same room, around the same table there at Shelley's, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Bob, take it.
The place to be.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see next week live. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
See you then, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.